Welcome to the third episode of the Sundance 2023 season of the Seventh Row podcast. Sundance runs from January 19th to 29th, 2023. Today, we'll be discussing some of the highlights of the festival that we've seen so far, most of which are films directed by women. I'm Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row, and this is my 10th consecutive year covering Sundance. I'm joined by Orla Smith, our executive editor, and this is her fourth year covering Sundance.
Hello.
Sundance marks the beginning of the new film year as a festival made up primarily of world premieres. In this podcast season, we'll be talking both about the films we see at the festival and how the films this year fit into the context of the history of the festival's programming.
Yes, and so over the course of the festival, we'll be dropping episodes. Some will be discussing particular themes at the festival, but a lot of them would be, as this one, just kind of regular dispatches about our thoughts on the films as they go, as they premiere, as their embargoes lift, and as we watch them. And we'll be trying to, as we go, kind of sum up our experience of like the different programs and the different themes we start emerging at Sundance and how that relates to our experiences, our past experiences covering Sundance and what it is as a festival.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's unique about our coverage of Sundance is how much we focus both on the world dramatic and world documentary films in competition, which tend to get ignored in favor of the buzzier US titles. And the other thing that we are now on the hunt for is what we're calling creative nonfiction documentaries, which are sort of documentaries that push the boundaries of nonfiction. What is, to what degree, where is the line between fiction and nonfiction? Are they using interesting formal techniques?
It's something. And I would say, you said we're calling it creative nonfiction, which is interesting
because we stole
that name from Penny Lane, who you interviewed many years ago about Nuts at Sun. Was that at Sundance that you interviewed?
Yeah, it was.
And she used the term creative nonfiction, which is not a super common term for these kinds of films, but was a term she liked to use, which was borrowed from kind of literature, where it's a more common turn of phrase.
Mm-hmm. I guess we also, you can watch the interview with her that we did with Carol Nguyen online. I think it's also on the podcast.
On the podcast.
And back in the feed where she and Carol talk about what creative nonfiction means. And that sort of became the basis of our book on.
Yes. Creative nonfiction. So we wrote a book called Subjective Realities, The Art of Creative Nonfiction Film, which features, our interview with Penny Lane and Carol Nguyen. And the terminology we used was inspired by Penny Lane a lot. And guess what? When I was looking through the program
of
Sundance this year, and when I was going through Next, there's a film called The Tuba Thieves. And it described itself as creative nonfiction in the program, which I thought was very exciting. The phrase seems to be becoming more prevalent as a descriptor, which is fun.
Yeah, which is, it's kind of funny that that's the film that got it. I actually only made it through half an hour of it. But it's a film where you have no fucking clue what is going on, what's like fiction and what's nonfiction, and not in the sense that like it's animated or there's just reenactments. It's like people speak in stagey ways, there's random footage, there's like footage that seems like it's that like seems overly written where people are talking. It's like it feels like you're watching a bad fiction film at some times. and I was half an hour into this 90-minute film where it kept telling us that these tubas were stolen from this high school, and I still had no idea why we cared and what that had to do with anything that was going on screen. So I hope that doesn't mean that the term creative nonfiction is now going to be used in a derogatory way or in a way to describe, I don't know what the hell this is.
Yeah, that's in the Next category.
And
I think Next category is an interesting place to look for creative nonfiction. Yeah. It's a mixture of fiction and documentary, and it tends to be in that category where you'll find the films that are most overtly playful with form. Although I'd say that also in the US doc competition and the world docs competition, you can not always, you get some more conventional docs in those sections, but you do also occasionally get more kind of formally daring docs. Like last year there was I didn't see you there, it was in the US docs competition, and it really easily could have been in the next competition as a super low budget film that's kind of like formally quite new.
But traditionally, I mean, where they used to throw all the creative nonfiction until it became more mainstream was in the New Frontier section. And that's where our number one film of last year was, 32 Sounds, which was a creative nonfiction film. It's actually going to get a theatrical run soon. They just remixed the sound so that it was designed for headphones. They just remixed it so that you could now go watch it in a theater, I think in the spring sometime.
Yeah, an amazing film.
And that's where Camera Person was way back in the day.
But it's interesting because you've noted before that Camera Person now would probably be in US more mainstream competition. Yeah, than the New Frontiers. It's interesting to see how our perception of what is like outside of the boundaries in documentary is shifting very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is obviously something we talk about a lot in the book. Which you can find at subjectiverealities.com, which will be in the show notes. I really love that book. I think it's got some really interesting conversations in it.
Well, and in it, you talk to the former head of Sundance who ran the nonfiction program at Sundance. And a lot of filmmakers who screened at Sundance and get insider information about... I talked to some of them too, but you talked to a lot more of the Sundance people.
You find out, I think, in the book, both in my conversation with Tabitha Jackson, who was kind of like, who ran the Art of Nonfiction initiative at Sundance, and actually the last few years she was the director of Sundance, and she just stepped down before this edition. So I talked to her about running that initiative, and you kind of get a sense of why so much interesting documentary has been emerging in the US specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those people have been filtered through the Sundance Art of Nonfiction initiative.
Yeah.
And I talked to a lot of people who had been through that initiative, like Robert Greene. And I talked to, like, I guess Kirsten Johnson was part of the initiative, I think.
Yeah.
In its early days, and she ended up actually marrying Tabitha Jackson. So that was a success story, I suppose.
They're in the Sachs family now.
They're in the Sachs family, Passages, Sundance, later in the week. And who else was it that was involved? I know Joe Beany wasn't...
There are a bunch that have screened at Sundance, but maybe weren't funded by Sundance, like Penny Lane, Joe Beany.
I think Joe Beany in some way had some involvement with the Art of Nonfiction Initiative, not as like a participant, but maybe as some kind of mentor.
Okay.
I think that's how he and Robert Greene... were connected, but I'm not exactly sure what that was, but I know he's been involved.
And there are a bunch of like Sundance films that end up being like breakout films, like Flea. We talked to the director of that film, which got 3 Oscar nominations, an animated documentary. Mm-hmm. And Pacho Velez, who had a great film, Searchers, that seems to have virtually disappeared, but was a really interesting piece of creative nonfiction. That's just
I thought that film was one that was going to get picked up because it's a very lovable film.
Yeah.
Like, it's very gentle and nice to watch.
Yeah. Well, there's still time.
Yeah. That's the kind of film where I was like, I watched it and I was like, this is going to like picked up by like Netflix or something.
Yeah.
And then now 2 years later, it's like disappeared.
I know. Well, hopefully not forever.
Hopefully not forever.
Should
we talk about some of the films today?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess we're going to start off with some of the world dramatic films.
We aim to watch all of the world dramatic films every year between us. And so we'll be following that journey on through these episodes.
I mean, I kind of became a really big fangirl for the world dramatic competition in my early years at Sundance because I kept seeing these really wonderful films that then disappeared forever. And I was like, if I don't cover this, no one will see it and I will never get to see this film again. And there were a ton of films like that that we loved, like the second feature from Amanda Kernel, Charter. What happened to that? Wonderful Norwegian film from Anne Sawitsky, Homesick, which you can watch on UK Netflix now. And then there's been some bigger breakouts, mostly British films that actually people have seen and you may heard of, like God's Own Country, that's screened in World Dramatic, and Joanna Hogg's The Souvenir, We wrote books on both of them. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the, it's a weird program because there's a bunch of stuff that's bad, which is why people avoid it because they don't want to take the risk. And then you'll often find the best film of the festival in World Dramatic.
The thing, yeah. The disappointing thing about World Dramatic is it's largely ignored by people on the ground,
yes.
especially because they will watch, there'll be, you know, English language films with big stars that screen at the same time, so they just won't see the World Dramatic films.
Yeah.
And so the only films that end up breaking out in World Dramatic are the films that are in English, which is kind of a bit paradoxical. But like The Souvenir was a big breakout, The God's yeah. Own Country, like you said, and 2 years ago, What Pleasure was the one that was kind of big and World Dramatic in 2020, and it was in there because the director is Swedish and the star is Swedish, but it's about a Swedish woman traveling to live in LA to be part of the LA porn industry. So it was very much a film that appealed to the US-centric kind of viewing patterns of Sundance audiences. So I think we find a lot of value in trying to be champions of World Dramatic yeah. in our coverage, because who else is going to?
Right. Yeah. Another film that was in World Dramatic that was British, the Ben Whishaw film Lilting, which we all swoon over in our Paddington
Lovely
episode.
Film.
There's a very funny moment where we all go, oh, he was so good in Lilting.
All at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, two Ben Whishaw films this year.
Yeah.
None of them will be as good as Lilting, maybe.
Well, one of them's in World Dramatic, so.
Yeah. Australian film.
Yeah.
Ben Whishaw, not Australian.
So... No, he's not, but he's pals with the mother of the director.
Yeah. Who is from New Zealand, not Australia.
Yeah, but Jane Campion's been living in Australia for, like, decades. So Alice Engler grew up in Australia.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess we're going to go from, like, best to worst here.
I suppose. I mean, there's nothing terrible we've seen so far. The thing with World Dramatic in the last few years is well, last year particularly, we watched all of them, I think, between us, right?
Yeah.
And
the
they
best
were...
we found was, like, good.
Yes. So, like, there was one film that kind of stood out, which was Girl Picture, which was the first film I actually saw of any Sundance film last year. And I was like, oh, this is like a really nice start. Like, it's a flawed film,
yeah.
but it feels very real and lived, and I liked it. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be something better and more dramatic.
There wasn't.
But I really enjoyed this.
Yeah.
And everything else was, like, pretty dull.
Yeah.
And that film ended up being the only one that stood out. And even so, it wasn't nearly as good as the best film of World Dramatic the previous year, The Dog Who Wouldn't Be Quiet, which was, like, a really stunning film.
Really great film, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it can only get better for World Dramatic. It's already on, like, a decent track record to be better, I think.
Yeah.
This
feels like a return to form for World Dramatic.
Yes. I don't think I've found my, like, film I fall in love with yet in World Dramatic, but I've at least found one that I really like.
Yeah.
Which maybe we should talk about first, because we both really like it.
So the film that we both really liked is called Slow. So Slow is a Lithuanian film, a second feature from the director, please forgive me, Maria Kavtaradze. And it's, I mean, one of the things that's really rare about it is one of the lead characters is asexual.
And weirdly, that's kind of, in a way, a kind of been a theme in the last 2 years of World Dramatic of the better films. I think Girl Picture was pretty ambiguous about whether the main character, well, not one of the, followed three characters, and one of them was basically questioning whether she was asexual or if she just had, like, bad experiences with men.
Or whether teenage boys just suck.
Yeah, exactly. And it was certainly like it didn't give you answers at the end, but it was a questioning asexuality storyline, and this is very much about someone who is, like, has decided that he is asexual and realized that about himself and is pretty confident about that, relatively speaking, even at the beginning of the film, which, yeah, is really rare.
But it's told from the perspective of his romantic partner, who is a woman who is heterosexual. I don't think she's asexual, but the film is interesting in its exploration of, like, what is she getting from sex? Mm-hmm. And is what she's getting from sex really about sexuality, or is it more about power or admiration or adoration or attention? Mm-hmm. And is that really what she wants, or is what she wants like tenderness and intimacy, which she gets from her asexual partner? But, you know, there's a lot of really interesting scenes where they kind of discuss or fight about sex or push the boundaries of sex. But, like, it's not – I don't think either of them really know whether what they're talking about is really about sex. And it's ambiguous to us as an audience. Like, did you do that because you really wanted to have sex, or did you do that because – like, sex is a stand-in for proving something, or for power, or something.
And it's like you said, she's not a character who's asexual, but being in a relationship with an asexual person does really force her to, like, think about what, you know, what she gets out of sex.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, what sex means to her in a relationship. And whether it is essential, and what about it is essential, and like whether she places what kind of, like, the way she has sex and intimacy wrapped up as an interchangeable thing when it isn't necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And
like episode two of Looking.
and I did like that, like, the film has some of the scenes you might expect where, you know, sex is initiated without much communication and there's confusion about what the other people want, but it doesn't, like, I found it refreshing the extent to which the characters, like, kind of do talk through things rather than it just being like, oh, you're asexual, but I'm just gonna, like, force you into sex and not believe you. That's not her attitude to start with, but their relationship does become more and more complicated as it becomes deeper and more intimate. And they both, like, have moments of, like, questioning what they want to give to their partner. And, like, he has moments where he's like, I'm just going to, like, try to push through this and have sex to prove a point. And there are moments, and she's, like, not into that. Well, there's,
one point where he does that, but...
And she's also annoyed by it. It's
very performative because her ex-boyfriend is drunk and sleeping it off on their couch in the room. And this is the first time he's initiated intercourse.
Yes, and she feels weird about that, and then there are moments where she gets sexual in a way that makes him uncomfortable, and it's all about, like, you know, to what extent are they communicating, to what extent are they being honest with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just one small thing that I really like is when characters in movies have really specific jobs that you don't usually see in movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, cool. So a character is like a dancer who is in, like, a modern dance troupe, but, like, to make money. She seems to freelance and she's doing this, like, short stint teaching a group of deaf kids to dance for this, like, camp thing. And she meets him because he's a freelance sign language interpreter who, like, interprets in various different scenarios throughout the movie. And I think that's a sign of, like, someone who's, like, created a real, like, rich world and rich characters in their movie, that, like, they're not just like, she works in a cafe, he works here, they meet because he walks into the cafe and they talk, like, there's a lot of, like, detail in their lives.
It feels really lived in, but they're kind of well chosen jobs for these characters to explore this subject matter. Because the fact that she's a dancer means that the film is really interested in bodies and the ways in which we interact with each other's bodies and touch, and to what degree is her dance about sensuality or sexuality, or, you know, like, she can touch and be tender with the people that she dances with, but is, you know, how divorced is that from sexuality? And then she's very, like, somebody who's very much in her body. So you can understand why other expressions, like bodily expressions, might be important to her. Not that, like, whatever, everybody can enjoy sex if they want to, if they happen to be, non-asexual. But, like, it kind of makes it fertile ground because we're exploring in the film the different ways in which she interacts with other bodies, not just with this one particular romantic partner. And likewise, like his role as an interpreter is a sort of nice way of lifting up the theme that, not theme, but like the idea that the film is about communication and the challenges of communicating things that are like hard to talk about. Like, could you imagine trying to translate the scenes that they have together? Like, good luck, because they don't even quite know what they mean. So they wouldn't be able to put it into words. And we don't quite know what they mean either, because they don't know. And sometimes we maybe know more than they do. And I mean, that's kind of what's, that dance is part of what makes the film really rich and interesting, is you can feel them, like, maybe they mean half of what they're doing and maybe they don't. Like, she clearly seems to, like, she seems to feel that she would enjoy sex more if her partner was also enjoying sex. But then when you see, but then she forces that with somebody that she knows is asexual. So then she goes and tries to have sex with sexual partners, who, with whom she has no intimacy, and you don't get the sense that she's getting lots of sexual pleasure out of it, that she's really enjoying it. Like, it feels like, obviously you can have sex without intimacy and it can be great, but that doesn't seem to be her experience in the film with those particular sexual partners. And some, and there are times when she sabotages or almost sabotages her relationship with her romantic partner because she decides to, she's feeling insecure about, like, giving up sex and what that means. And so, yeah, that becomes a conflict in the film. And yeah, so it has a nice way of, like, respecting both of their sexualities and their feelings about it, and also about the way that they're uncomfortable or don't know how to navigate the fact that they care about this other person and they don't want to push the other person into something they don't want, but that might be what they want, might be counter to their own desires.
And it does something that I've seen attempted in a few films, but it does it well in a way that I've never seen it done well, which is kind of turning, like, everyday scenes into dance scenes.
And that, which, and as a way of showing intimacy too.
So I've, the one that I know I've seen this at least twice, but in recent years, but the one that leads to mind as, like, a bad example of this was, what was the name of that film? Spring Blossom? Was that what it's called?
The bad one?
That's what it was called, right? Spring Blossom, which was, like, the, written and directed by, like, a 17-year-old or something.
Yeah, the daughter of,
what's his face?
Vincent Lindon.
Suzanne Lindon. And there's about three scenes in that where suddenly, like, she's walking down the street. She does a little dance to express how she's feeling. And Slow does that, I think, also about three points, where you'll be watching a scene and then suddenly the movements become just slightly more dance-like, but not to an extent where it's, like, really, really drawing attention to itself, to an extent that almost feels like natural movement, but it's just accentuated and choreographed to a slightly heightened extent, and it's done to sort of show, you know, the relationship between bodies in a space and two characters' relationship to each other, or a group of characters' relationship to each other, and really foregrounding that in the narrative. And I thought that it's done, like, they executed it in such a natural and beautiful way in this film that didn't feel really cheesy in a way that I've seen it feel really cheesy in the past. Like, it really did, like, feel really well done.
Because I think that the what you're describing as dance or movement is sort of becomes part of their language of intimacy, and one of the ways that they, you know, connect to one another across a crowded room is through mimicking each other's movements, or one of the ways they show intimacy and care for one another and connection is in the way that, like, they do the dishes in time.
Yeah. And they're both people who, like, for their jobs communicate through movement.
That's true. She's a dancer
and his, like, we see several scenes of him, like, doing interpretation for music videos, and you just see how much, like, how expressive he is as a sign language interpreter, and how expressive you have to be in that job to convey tone as well as meaning. And so it's in their nature, both as characters, and it's a joy to kind of see them also, like, interact with movement. I thought it was really well directed. I'm really excited to see what this director does next, because in a way that not all Sundance filmmakers do, she has a real handle of, like, choreographing actors, working with actors, framing basic filmmaking stuff.
Well, her first feature actually screened at TIFF a few years ago. I'm hoping we might be able to track it down. But that's kind of been an interesting pattern this year, is a bunch of people who had international filmmakers who previously screened films at TIFF are now at Sundance. There's another one in World Dramatic for a film that is also one of those films that's, like, well-made, but... and well-directed, and I feel like this director is one day going to make a film that I really like. Haven't quite gotten there yet, but that's Heroic, which is a Mexican film by David Zonana, and his first film, Workforce, screened in the platform section at TIFF, which I love to complain about, and that was... I did not really like that film. It was sort of about class warfare, and it had a lot of lockdown shots, like, very formal style. And it was like, I can tell you, like, know how to use a camera, but this, it was like a really long, drawn out film that could have been a lot shorter and didn't really do anything I didn't expect. And the same is kind of true of Heroic, but his directorial style is more well suited to this. Like, in Workforce, it was basically about a bunch of construction workers and, like, the fiefdoms that happened within that, and exploitation. And Heroic is about a man of, I guess, indigenous heritage who ends up, he speaks his indigenous language in Mexico, and he joins the Mexican army, it would seem, basically for the health insurance, because his mom has some kind of disease that has, I think it's kidney disease and dialysis, but that has costly treatments that is, they say it's 2,000 pesos a treatment and three times a week, so they can't afford it, and we figure that out about halfway through, that's why he joined the army, and maybe also because his dad was in the army, and his dad has disappeared, and he's maybe hoping to connect with his dad. Maybe that's kind of vague. But anyway, the film is, like, you know, it reminded me a lot of The Inspection, in the sense that it's kind of, well, The Inspection is a little bit gentler, but it's basically about how basic training in the army breaks you as a human being and involves torture and hazing. Which I will note is quite different from the documentary about this, where the military begrudgingly allowed a documentarian to film the Canadian military in First Stripes, which one of my takeaways from that movie was never join the military, but like every film I've seen from anywhere else in North America says really, really don't join the military. If you want to be in the military, come to Canada. So it has a lot of interesting stuff going on, but it's really, really unpleasant to watch because of all the brutal violence. But I think it's a director, David Zonana is a director who is going to, you know, keep doing interesting work. And I think the film is interesting. I just kind of wish it was, I don't know, had something a bit more than, yeah, the military is bad, but people end up in the military because they are desperate. But on a happier note, I guess, is the film that we were both looking forward to, which, because it stars Harris Dickinson as a young dad. but playing much older than he is.
Just doing like, a Paul Mescal.
Doing a Paul Mescal.
He's playing about 5 years older than he is.
Yeah. Well, and like After Sun, it's about a dad and his prepubescent daughter with an absent mother. I mean, this one, the mother's dead. Working class. So I don't know. That seems to be a new genre of film emerging from Britain, or getting funded at least. I quite liked it. I don't think you liked
have
it.
Have we said
as
the
much
name of
did.
The oh, it, film or it? The actor?
I'm not sure.
The film is called Scrapper, and the actor you're referring to is Harris Dickinson.
Yeah, who is one of our 50 screen stars of tomorrow, and despite starring in the Palme d'Or winner, Triangle of Sadness, people still don't seem to know who he is.
He didn't get that BAFTA nom.
I know, and he deserved it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, we are huge Harris Dickinson fans, which we talked about at more length in the first episode of this season. But he's great, and we were both really looking forward to Scrapper, like you said. And yeah, I think you liked it more than I did. I wasn't a huge fan, although, you know, there are some good things about it. For example, Harris Dickinson is very good in it.
He gets to do comedy and drama, which, I mean, when you get Harris Dickinson doing comedy, you have gold.
Yes, he is a brilliant comedic force. All you have to do is watch only his scenes in Mateus and Maxime.
It's only like 5 minutes. Just skip over the rest of the film.
Yeah, you can skip over the rest. His scenes are amazing. Very good. Yeah. Yeah, it's basically about a girl who lives, according to the synopsis, in London. I don't know where that was.
Oh, she lives in, I think, in Dagenham.
In Dagenham. Oh, okay. Fine then. She lives in Dagenham. And her mother dies before the film begins. We meet her, and she is living alone in her house and pretending to the authorities that she is in the care of her uncle, which seems difficult to pull
her
off.
Her uncle
but...
named Winston Churchill.
Yes. The movie runs on some kind of whimsical logic.
Yeah.
And she manages to get away with convincing them that she's living with her uncle, because when the authorities call, she gets the guy who works at the local corner shop to record like individual lines into a tape recorder, where he's like, Georgie is doing fine, thank you, and stuff like
we just
that. And then
spaghetti bolognese.
Yeah. And then when the authorities call, she just plays the relevant clip from her tape recorder. And they're like, thank you, Winston Churchill. And then they hang up.
Which I think is the point where I fell in love with the film, because I just loved this girl. And I thought that was so clever. And so I was willing to go with it on its whimsies, which we probably both agree that they don't always work. I just didn't mind it as much as you did, I think.
I think the film is trying very hard to kind of have this very, like, this very whimsical tone, right down to, like, kind of, like, almost, like, comic panel, like, things with, like, the spiders who live in her house.
Well, and there's, like, this weird sort of home video footage of interviewing people who know her, but it's unclear who's supposed to have been shooting this, and why are we doing it in this style, and it doesn't quite jive with the rest of the film, which is... like, somewhat whimsical, as you say, but naturalistic, more or less.
Yeah, there are moments that feel quite realist, but then there are also, like, and so when certain, like, important plot points, like, rely on stuff that, like, kind of wouldn't be physically possible, such as convincing the authorities you live with an uncle called Winston Churchill, and then just not realizing that your uncle doesn't exist. It doesn't quite always fit together, but this young girl, Lola Campbell is her name, the actress, is really charming, and also given this performance that is very kind of grounded, but also does work with the kind of whimsical tone, because she's very like confident little girl. And yeah, again, there are moments when it doesn't tonally work, but it's never her fault. It's kind of the film's weird tonal balancing. And then at some point, Harris Dickinson arrives as her estranged father, who I don't think she's ever met. and who's been living in Ibiza.
I think I don't know that he left before she was born, but he left when she was a baby.
She doesn't remember him.
Yeah.
So he's been living his fun life in Ibiza. He's about 30 now, and then he comes home and he's like, I guess this is my house now. And she is not having that. And
been surviving by stealing bicycles, which leads to some very funny sequences.
But that's where the similarities between this and After Sun do stop at 26-year-old actor plays 30-something-year-old father of a 12-year-old girl.
Also precocious girl, also home yeah, but videos. I'm talking about
the character himself is very different. Very different. Yeah, whereas Paul Mescal plays very comforting, nice dad. Harris Dickinson plays kind of a dick who is not at all grown up himself, and really has to learn to kind of be a parent throughout the film. I mean, I'm not saying he's only a dick. I mean,
the flip side of that is the Paul Mescal character in After Sun is somebody who's had to bear the responsibility of being a parent since he was 16. So he has a lot of resentment
How old is the kid in After Sun?
I guess if he's supposed to be 30, maybe it was since he was 20 or something.
I think both these characters are only supposed to be about, like, I think Harris Dickinson is supposed to be 30 in this, and Paul Mescal is supposed to be 31 in After Sun.
Okay, so but the kids are about 12, so
what you're saying is that Paul Mescal's character has borne the responsibility of being a parent, and Harris Dickinson's character hasn't.
Right, which, you know, in After Sun, he's really weighed down by this, and that's why, I don't know, I guess I shouldn't spoil this yet, but he's really depressed, and the film is about his depression and his suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. And Harris Dickinson, by contrast, like, yeah, he's been a deadbeat dad for the last 12 years, but the flip side of that is he's had the opportunity to be a kid, and, like, he still is a kid, but, like, I think you're maybe more ready to be a dad if you're starting it at 30 and you've had some time to live than having to figure out how to do it at 18.
Yes, although, to be clear, he has majorly fucked up.
Oh, yeah, he has majorly fucked up, and...
Like, good for him that he got to grow up. Like,
no.
The mother didn't, and his daughter didn't get to have a father.
No, I'm not excusing his behavior, I am saying, like, she might be getting, like, if that's the...
10 years down the line, she might be getting a better dad or a dad at all.
And she just got lucky that she had a great mom.
Yes. But
as she points out, it was pretty selfish of him to not do anything, that most dads at least send money.
Yes. And he basically spends the movie kind of amusingly making very poor excuses for himself before he learns how to communicate with his child and be her friend and also her father.
Mm-hmm.
And it's played in a way where he gets to play the sensitivity of that, but he also gets to play kind of the, like, very funny moments of his immaturity.
Yeah.
And Harris Dickinson is so good at capturing both of those things and bringing them together.
And the earnestness that he really wants to be there for his daughter, but doesn't really know how.
Yeah, and I think he's almost, like, resistant to that in himself. Like, he's a complicated character, because he shows up and he kind of tries very vaguely to be nice to her, and he understands that, like, being a parent is something that he should do, and he feels bad that her mom is dead. But then he also, like, when she is, you know, talks back to him, he's like, oh, I guess the thing I should do is, like, reprimand her and not understand that her anger is very justified.
Mm-hmm.
And he just has absolutely no idea, like, the way you're supposed to emotionally behave towards your child.
He storms in expecting the rights of a parent without having earned them.
Yes, exactly, that's it.
But I mean, one of the things I do like about the whimsy in the film is that I think it kind of helps to, like, there's a sadness behind it. So you kind of, you're enjoying the funny things that are happening, but it's partly the things are funny because that's their way of coping with the sadness. And it's nice to see a film that doesn't just want to be 100% bleak all the time. Because we get so many of those. and like, one of the scenes of his immaturity is one of my favorite scenes in the film, where they're standing at a tube station and they see this posh couple arguing across the platform. And so he encourages his daughter to play the wife and he's going to play the husband. And they have an imaginary conversation about what they imagine the posh people are arguing about. And they put on posh accents to do it. It's very funny. And then at the end, the posh couple across the platform are like, you know, we can hear you.
Yeah, that's probably the standout scene of the film.
But I do think, like I agree with you that there are some things in the film that are stylistically a bit all over the map and don't quite work. Including the fact that, like, she's building a fort in her mother's bedroom to get to the sky, where her mother's in the sky, because her mother told her she was in the sky, and she wants to break through the roof. And
yeah, I kind of, like, mentally checked
out. She's such a smart kid that if that was really her plan, I don't think it would be to build a fort on the second floor of her house.
Yes.
Even if she really believed her mother was in the sky and she had to climb up there, she would, like, go to London and go to a tall building or something. Like, I don't know, like, she's a smart kid. But I do think that Charlotte Regan does a great job with the actors, and I also think there's a lot of really lovely blocking in the film, where she really uses the frame to show, like, the distance between characters and opposite.
Charlotte Regan is the director of the film.
And the writer. To show, like, the distance between the characters and, like, having to bridge the gap, and the way that the girl is, like, close to her friend, but it takes a while before she and her father can be close together in the same frame. And the way that Regan also, like, uses the walls in the what to call where they live,
house.
Well, no, but it's like a house. Like, not the house, but, like, the area, like, because it's a bunch of townhouses and apartment buildings.
You mean like an estate?
Estate, yeah, that's probably the word. So she uses the walls of this, like, the sort of estate where they live, as a way of kind of showing how people feel trapped, or also how small their worlds are, or intimacy or lack thereof. And so there's some really smart use of the locations to also tell the story, the emotional story of what's going on with the characters. So it feels like a first feature, but I think there's a lot of good stuff going on in here, and it's not just that Harris Dickinson is going to class up anything. I liked it more than you did, but
You liked When It Melts?
Yes. It's hard to say.
Don't ask me.
When It Melts, when It Melts is a movie about a, like, 12-year-old who gets sexually assaulted by her best male friend.
You appreciated some of the things that When It Melts does.
Yeah. It's very smart, I think, about the weird sort of girl sexuality that happens when you're on the cusp of puberty, where, like, some of your friends are going through puberty, but maybe you aren't quite yet. And it's a film in which it's about this girl who's kind of a tomboy, and her two best friends are boys, and they call themselves the Three Musketeers, and you know, they're inseparable. But then one summer, the boys are sort of a little bit further into puberty than she is, and suddenly they're interested in girls, and they're interested in sex, and that means that she kind of gets excluded from the club. And worse than that is that, you know, they basically teach her that the only value a girl has, and therefore that she has, is as a sexual object. And they recruit her in these really gross, sexually exploitive games that they play with the girls in the town. Basically the game is, you know, we're going to tell you a riddle, and if you, every time you guess wrong, you have to take off an item of clothing. But if you guess it right, then we'll give you some amount of money. And they pick really hard riddles so that the girls have to get naked, and the girls don't feel comfortable doing this unless their female friend is there, the star of the film. So she becomes complicit in their harassment of these girls. And the film starts off in the present day, and she's now, like, I don't know, in her late 20s or early 30s. And I think the girl who caused this problem and one of the boys is now getting married. And there's going to be a memorial for the boy's brother who died when they were, like, years ago, back before the summer that we see in flashbacks. So she decides to go home and, I don't know, confront her past-ish. But she's, like, a really unhappy, depressed person who doesn't really know how to have social interactions because she's been traumatized by what's happened to her. And the film keeps showing us flashbacks as she goes back to the town and interacts with people to explain the backstory of what happened that one summer to fuck her up for the rest of her life. So I think the film is really smart and sensitive in how it deals with those flashbacks. And I haven't seen a lot of films that are kind of about being in the present moment of sexual assault as a child. Like, we have films like The Tale, which is about reflecting on how messed up those memories are. Or Slalom, about, you know, a 16-year-old girl. Or Una, about an adult who was raped as a, I don't know, 10 or 11-year-old. But it's her adult memory looking back. And this film, those scenes from the past don't really feel like memories. They feel like proper flashbacks. And so it's partly about the confusion of, like, not full, like, being uncomfortable but not fully understanding what's going on and what she's complicit in and what her friends are doing, and not that she's rewritten history to make it okay, but that she's navigating this and doesn't know how to and gets traumatized by it and kind of stuck in the moment of trauma. So I think that stuff is all really good. It's just the film doesn't really do much more than that. It doesn't really deal with her as an adult, aside from the fact that she's really unhappy and it shows her being unhappy.
Yeah. Speaking of sexual repression / trauma, I guess the only other world dramatic we haven't talked about that we've seen so far is Mama Cruz. And I won't linger on it too long, because to be honest, it's the one I have the least to say about of all of these. It was one of the first films I saw of, and it is fine. It's a Spanish film, and it's about an older woman who is, like, well, the inciting incident is she gets an iPad, and accidentally gets, like, a porn pop-up on her iPad, and she is very religious and lives in, like, a very religious community, and she, even her, like, job is to, like, dress up, like, the wood carvings and the statues of, like, Jesus and the Virgin Mary that are in the church, her local church. So, yeah, suffice to say, she's very repressed. And the movie is basically about her discovering porn and masturbation and then joining, like, a sex therapy group. But the problem with it, I suppose, is that I've just spoken about it for a minute there, and you already know exactly what happens in the film now. Because it kind of...
That's a Sundance problem. I mean, not just Sundance. That's, like, a lot of festival films.
But yeah, but it is a Sundance problem that a film has one idea. And I think the problem with this film and several films I think I've seen is that the movie begins, you can kind of vaguely map out all the beats of the film in your head. Yeah. And it kind of plays out that way.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that the film was about this. Like, the best parts of it are when she is within this group, and you get the interactions between these different women who are all like, you know, introducing each other to their favorite sex toys and like talking through their issues. Because the problem with this main character is she is so repressed and so quiet. She isn't someone who ever kind of really voices her feelings, and so the movie only really comes to life in these scenes where she is amongst these kind of more lively women, and I just don't, it has those pockets of energy, and I don't think it necessarily does a ton with them. It has a kind of fun final image, but yeah, I don't know. I wasn't so hot on it, but it certainly wasn't, you know, a terrible film.
I just realized that I actually saw one other world dramatic film that I already forgot about. So that's how you know how good it is, which is Girl, a British film. I won't say much about it aside from that. It was nice to see a British film that was about black characters.
It's set in Scotland, right?
Yes, it is, in Glasgow. Yeah. And it's about, yeah, it's about black characters who mostly interact with black characters, which we don't see enough of in British
film. But we will see it in Sundance later in the festival with Rye Lane.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm very excited to see it set in South London.
So, I mean, unfortunately, it's a film that is another one idea film, and it also has sexual trauma in it, of course, and a woman who became a mother too young, because it's Sundance. But my big takeaway from it is I'm excited about the cinematographer, Tasha Back, because it's beautifully, really beautifully lit, beautifully shot. And so I think this is her first feature as a cinematographer. She's done some TV, and she's done some shorts, and she's worked as a camera, an assistant in the camera department, but now she's a DP, and I think she's someone to watch.
If you're enjoying our curation and discussion of under-the-radar female-directed and foreign films at the 2023 Sundance Film Festival, you might also enjoy past episodes of the podcast. Our episodes that are more than 6 months old are only available to members. In addition, many of our new episodes are for members only. All of our episodes are carefully curated so that we only discuss films we think are really worth your time and in-depth critical analysis. We tend to dedicate episodes to thought-provoking, under-discussed films that no other podcast would cover with such depth, from Jerzy Skolimowski's Io to the films of Kelly Reichardt. To listen to all of our episodes, become a member today. You'll also get a discount in our shop to purchase our books from filmmakers like Celine Sciamma, Kelly Reichardt, and Joanna Hogg, all of whom have screened films at Sundance. To become a member, go to 7th-row.com/join.
I feel like we should talk about Fancy Dance, because it's the rare film to screen at Sundance that is written and directed by an Indigenous filmmaker about Indigenous characters, starring Indigenous actors.
Yes, and it stars Lily Gladstone,
who is
our favorite.
With appearance from Crystal Lightning, who we are big fans of.
Yes, and speaking of DPs, I'm a big fan of the DP of this film, Carolina Costa, who shot Workforce. That film that you were talking about earlier in the episode. And she shot Hala, which was slightly better looking than an American indie usually is. And she shot Crystal Swan, which was a beautiful film.
Oh, wow. She's really worked all over the place.
Yes, and she shot this film, Dance of the 41, which is a Mexican film, Netflix film.
Oh, right.
2 years ago, which I also thought looked very nice. So but all of those films really like have quite distinct and different aesthetics, and it's also covering a range of different countries. So I think her work is really interesting, and I was watching Fancy Dance, and I thought this does look You know, again, better than an American who usually does. And there you go. It's Carolina Costa.
I guess a big draw for us for this film was Lily Gladstone, because she was also one of our 50 screen stars of tomorrow from 2021 alongside Harris Dickinson. I think this is the first time she's been back at Sundance with a feature film since Certain Women, though she's
But she was back with a short film by this director.
Yeah.
A few years ago, she had a short film called Little Chief in Sundance in 2020, which I did watch at that time. And I thought that their film, it was a film that showed promise, but, you know, I wasn't immediately like, oh, Erica Tremblay is, you know, the next big talent. But I really think that she has, you know, delivered something really interesting with this film. And also, like, used Lily Gladstone really well, which I'm very grateful for, because not enough people are using Lily Gladstone at all.
That's for sure. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the film is about Lily Gladstone's character Jax, who is suddenly caring for her almost pubescent niece Roki, who is actually played by an Indigenous actress who I think is Canadian. Funnily enough, she plays Crystal Lightning's daughter on the TV show Three Pines.
I thought she was really good.
She is really wonderful.
She was really great.
Isabel DeRoy Olsen.
And she's playing, I think, a 14. I don't know how old she is, but she's playing a 14.
Well, she's just getting her period, so I guess she's a bit younger. But
I think she said at some point she was 14, but I might be misremembering.
So they live on the Seneca Cayuga Reservation in Oklahoma. And it's nice to see that this is one of the films that's in the sort of, I guess, newer pattern of actually hearing Indigenous languages in a film that is Indigenous, because, of course, part of what's happened with colonialism is there's been huge language loss among Indigenous communities and nations. And, you know, 10 years ago when Rhymes for Young Ghouls was made, it was pretty rare to see people actually speaking their language in the film, which happened in that film. And now we're seeing more and more films that not only do you have people speaking the language, but talking about it and talking about the need for language revitalization and talking about the loss of language. Like, that was a big part of Run Woman Run, a Canadian film by Zoe Lee Hopkins that we talked about on the podcast.
And I interviewed Zoe Lee Hopkins as well.
Yeah.
And actually, this is something Lily Gladstone herself, is just as a person, is really passionate about.
Yes.
Because I interviewed her, and it was a wonderful interview. We will link to it in the show notes. And I interviewed her specifically about her work with Kelly Reichardt. So we talked a lot about Certain Women, but specifically I was talking to her about her part in First Cow, which is a much smaller part but a really significant part, and there's a lot of nuance in that part because she plays a translator between the Indigenous language that she's speaking and Toby Jones speaking English, and she also is his wife, and there's a lot in that, like, one scene part that's nuanced about the way that she is translating his words. And so I got into a really fascinating conversation with Lily Gladstone about translation and about, like, her passion for, like, thinking about Indigenous languages in translation, and how she said that if she hadn't been an actress, she would have been a studied linguistics. And so, yeah, that's, I really recommend reading that, because she is so smart and thoughtful in how she talks about acting and language and everything.
And that's in our ebook on Kelly Reichardt's films, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, which you can get at reichardtbook.com.
Yeah,
I'm so glad you picked up on my setup, because that was the whole point of that preamble, was for you to talk about your interview.
yeah, I really love that interview. I would say it's a very stressful film. It's about kind of events and bad things piling up and up and up into increasingly stressful situations. But it also finds like moments to slow down and have very tender moments between Lily Gladstone's character and her niece. Mm-hmm. It takes place, or the film begins, shortly after the disappearance of Lily Gladstone's sister, who is the mother of the niece character. The niece is called Roki, and it's set in the wake of that and leading up to the community's powwow, which was, the niece Roki is super excited about, and she would, you know, attend every year with her mother, and they would always win the mother and daughter dance. And it's kind of, Lily Gladstone is telling her niece that her mother will be back any day now, and will definitely be at the powwow, while she also knows that, you know, Indigenous women going missing is very common and they rarely show up again. So it's actually, there's a series in the at Sundance this year called Murder at Bighorn, which is like a documentary, like a docu-series about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And this is like a kind of fiction tackling of that issue, and I think it does it a lot better. Like, it's a lot better at, through character, exploring kind of the systemic issues mm-hmm. that lead to women being going missing and being murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a bunch of threads going on in the film. Lily Gladstone is constantly investigating her sister's disappearance because the police are doing nothing to help. Her half-brother is also a police officer, and so you get that perspective of him being part of the system and, like, also, you know, wanting to push back against the system slightly, but also playing into it to an extent. And then at the same time, the authorities take Roki away from her aunt because she has a criminal record, and place her with Lily Gladstone's white father and the woman that he remarried with after Lily Gladstone's mother died. And there's a very tense relationship between them because he basically kind of like completely left the reservation after his ex-wife died and isn't super committed to keeping ties with his family, even as he professes to care about them. And so she kidnaps her niece to take her to the powwow, and the authorities don't like that. And so they essentially are on the run while she's investigating this disappearance. And as I said, things get increasingly stressful as, like, all these pressures that Lily Gladstone's character faces
mm-hmm.
just build and compound onto each other. But I also appreciated how, like I said, the movie finds moments to show the tenderness between her and her niece
mm.
and, like, why they're so important to each other. Like, there's a moment when Roki gets her first period, and so they kind of have to stop their mad dash, and she has to kind of, you know, talk to her about what's going on, and then they celebrate it.
They do ceremony for it before. I mean, yes, they go out for cake and sweets, but before that, they
actually and she
do...
orders all that she wants.
More food.
She's like, can
than
I have the pancakes with
eat.
Strawberry? Can I have the waffles with strawberry? Can I have the strawberry cake? Oh, and also, do you have anything for celebrations, like a cake? It's very sweet.
As far as I know, I think this is the first American feature film about missing and murdered Indigenous women.
I'm not aware of another one. There may be one.
And they're, like, there, I mean, it's something that there have been there's been at least one feature in Canada, which is Rustic Oracle, which mm-hmm. we've talked about on our Indigenous YA podcast, which
is also a road trip movie.
Also a road trip movie, because guess what? The cops do nothing. And if you want to find the missing person, you have to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. But that film, really fantastic film, is sort of about a more of a middle class family. And this film is about what it's like to be lower down on the economic ladder, and how that makes mm-hmm. this even more challenging when you can't afford like a hotel or food or gas, and yes. you don't have a car. So it was interesting yeah. to see that perspective. I mean, certainly I'd recommend checking out Rustic Oracle, which is available worldwide on VOD.
It's a really great film.
A really fantastic film. But I guess they're like, the U.S. is suddenly having a moment about media about missing and murdered Indigenous women, because in the last year we have had so there's the American series Alaska Daily, which was shot in BC, and all of these that I'm going to talk about that the U.S. is having a moment about are all made by settlers and have settler stars. But there was Alaska Daily, which is like produced by the guy who made Spotlight, and it stars mm-hmm. Hilary Swank, but it co-stars Grace Dove, who we loved in Monkey Beach. She is an Indigenous actress from Canada.
You may know her as Leonardo DiCaprio's dead wife in The Revenant.
Right. Also that, there's another connection. Everybody has got to marry Leonardo DiCaprio.
Lily Gladstone.
So coming soon.
Yeah.
Lily Gladstone married to Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay. I feel like I said this before when I thought the movie would have come out last year, but my prediction is in a year's time, Lily Gladstone will have an Oscar.
I hope so. Like, about time. Where's her Oscar for certain women?
Yeah.
But
I'm on the record now.
There's also been the Canadian TV show, Canadian-British co-production Three Pines, which is not about missing and murdered Indigenous women, but there's a ongoing storyline about it throughout that. And Crystal Lightning plays the mother of a girl who's gone missing, and the daughter who is, she has two daughters, and her daughter who isn't missing is played by Isabel DeRoy Olsen, who plays the daughter in Fancy mm-hmm. Dance. And then of course there's Murder at Bighorn. All of those mm-hmm. are made by settlers, but I mean, so they all have their problems as far as how they address missing and murdered Indigenous women and colonialism and all of that.
But and then you have Reservation kind of Dogs.
Pardon?
And then you have Reservation Dogs.
Yes, but does that deal with missing and murdered Indigenous women?
Oh, no, I just thought you were talking about Indigenous, like, mainstream TV shows in general. But no, I don't know if it does. I haven't seen
that
it.
That one's proper Indigenous. It's made by and stars yes. Indigenous actors.
Devery
and
Jacobs.
People, yes. Who made a short film about missing and murdered Indigenous women like 6 years ago or more, that I think was produced by Jeff Barnaby.
One really great thing about Fancy Dance is, like, I feel like they're, especially when they're made by settlers, there's a lot of like narratives around Indigenous people in films that are like, isn't this miserable? Aren't they all having a terrible time? Aren't reserves terrible?
Or like, also it's their fault they went missing because they drink or they do drugs or they sell drugs and they come from a broken home or something like that, without any context as to how that is not their fault. Colonialism.
But even outside of the context of missing and murdered Indigenous women, like I think about, what's it, that fucking movie called? Songs My Brothers Taught Me.
Oh, God.
By Chloe Zhao.
That fucking movie is a good description for it.
Which is basically like poverty porn on a reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really liked about Fancy Dance was the like, it does such a good job of showing how, like, the connection to her community is so good and nourishing mm-hmm. for the niece.
Yeah.
And how she, and how it's traumatic for her to be taken to her, her white grandparents.
Yes.
Who are
well-intentioned-ish.
Yes, they're really well, I think they're really well-written characters because they are not, like, super evil. They're just white people who really do not understand why connection to the community is important for their granddaughter.
And who have and been absent from her life
yes.
for her. Like, they have made no attempt to be in her life.
And like, the grandfather character, he basically just... He talks about, like, well, I did my time living on the reserve. You'd expect me to stay there, you know, like, and he, and the interesting thing about them is they do this really terrible thing, which is when Lily Gladstone kidnaps her niece. Basically, she leaves a note. She's like, I'm just taking her to the powwow. I'll be gone a couple of days. And this is their daughter, but they call, and Lily Gladstone assumes that they won't call the police on her because these are her parents, but they do.
Well,
because
her dad
they
and
are,
her stepmom.
Yes, their dad and her stepmom, but they do because they're just they're settlers who are very tied to the rules of, you know, colonial society, and like, we must follow the rules. The rules are important. We must call the police on our daughter, and it's
well. I mean, the flip side of that too is there are some good intentions in that, even if it results in bad actions, because. First, like, there are questions about whether Jax, Lily Gladstone's character, is really equipped to be a parent right now, and whether or not the girl would have, Roki would have a more stable home with her grandparents. But the trauma of that might be, you know, like, whatever Jax's failings or difficulties may outweigh the trauma of separating Roki from her community. Yeah.
And but there's not really a discussion about that. Like, she's simply ripped from her home because of the rule that you cannot stay with her because she has a criminal record.
Right.
But it's not actually, like, really a decision made based on observations
Lily
Gladstone is an appropriate parent.
It's like 60s Scoop all over again, which is a thing that happened in Canada where Indigenous children were removed from their Indigenous parents and sent to live with white people they didn't know.
And then when Roki, I was just gonna say, when Roki is taken away from Jax, Jax actually at least says to them, you can't do that. There are rules about, like, taking Indigenous children away from their community and giving them to white people. And they were like, well, you know, you have white relatives, so we can get around that.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think where the film is smart to give the nuance of the challenge here is that the grandparents are aware that if they screw up, Roki could be sent to live with a complete stranger.
Hmm.
So one of the reasons they call the cops is because they don't want her to become completely disconnected from her community. They just don't understand how traumatic it is already to be with them, so they're in a difficult position. Like,
and they don't understand why and how important the powwow is to her.
You know, it's more, I think it's less about them being horrible and more about the systems being unforgiving, and they're put in, you know, they signed paperwork saying that, you know, that she couldn't take them away and they were responsible and she couldn't have unsupervised visits with Roki. So, like, you can understand why they would do this. It's they're not like they're, and what's great is they're not villains. They're flawed.
No.
They screwed up. They're, you know, they misjudged the situation and didn't understand the significance of the consequences of their actions, and
they have a lot more trust in the system
than
their Indigenous children and grandchildren do,
and that they more reasons. Trust than they should have. They don't really understand what they've done. They don't think it's going to be as bad as it is, and I think it's nice that you have a film where it illustrates, because it's kind of like the best case scenario of if you had to be torn away from your family and sent to your family you didn't know, at least these are people who are well-meaning. ish. I mean, it, like, it's ish. I mean, it's probably like a slightly better case scenario,
but there could be a lot worse.
It could be a lot worse.
Yeah.
So it really lets you see the rock and hard place that it puts people in.
And they don't understand how, like, important, like, going to the powwow is, for example.
Yeah, they just think it's, like, Roki. A party. They don't get that it's a huge...
they're like, we're kind of busy this weekend, so they don't understand it's something that, like, they really need to make the effort for, because they don't understand what the importance of connection to your community as an Indigenous person. They just think it's just like, you know, moving to a different town.
Yeah, they're like, it's really important to us that you keep your connections to your culture. Your cultures are not even, I don't even think they say it as nicely as that. It's like, we know your culture is important to you, as though it's like a thing that's in a box that you can take out when it's convenient, as opposed to part of her identity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the film has some kind of outlandish things that happen that feel a little bit like indie movie Sundance strains believability, but where it has like...
But it's also like
minor missteps. It's not enough that I would say the movie isn't... Like, it does so many things so well.
But I think the reason that also, like, something that one of the reasons it has those problems is because, unlike most Sundance films, it's, like, so full of ideas.
Yeah.
Like, it has a ton to say, and it's trying to fit all of that into 90 minutes. And it is, you know, it's dealing with, like, again, this, like, investigation of a missing person's case, while also, like, the relationship with the niece and the traveling to the powwow and the importance of that.
And the dynamics within the family and the
And use of the language
and
exactly
dancing.
It's packing.
It's
packing so much into kind of like a thriller plot.
Yeah.
And while also finding like moments of respite, like the sequence where she gets her period and at the cafe and all these like moments where the film actually does slow down.
Yeah.
And
because it's really a character film, even though it has this, as you say, sort of like road trip and thriller plot, it manages to still be a character drama that... Yeah. It's mostly about Jax and Roki, but the other characters around them feel very three-dimensional and filled out, even if they are, you know, relatively small parts.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was really impressive, especially for a feature debut. And I, at Sundance, I am always welcome for a film with too many ideas, rather than a film with not enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's also a film that it has too many ideas, but it doesn't feel like it was a film that, like, they needed a budget for a miniseries and couldn't get it.
No.
Like, it feels like it's a feature film.
It doesn't feel too overstuffed.
No.
I don't think. I think, like, because it's doing so much, there are some, like you said, moments of strained believability. Like, it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. But I think it also, it's structured quite neatly to, like, slot all these narratives into each other, like it works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's impressive to balance that much, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one of my favorites so far, certainly.
Yeah, same. That and Slow are our two strong feature recommendations.
Well,
by feature I mean
fiction
feature.
Fiction feature, yeah. Well, to talk about the docs, I mean, I think my favorite film that I've seen at the festival so far is this film in the US doc competition called A Still Small Voice, which was directed by Luke Lorenzen. I think it's his second or third, and it's a documentary that is... So it's difficult to describe. It's sort of in the creative nonfiction vein, but it's not necessarily so much like formally or structurally like inventive as it is just like it's shot so with such formal precision that you're kind of like, there are sequences I have no idea how they shot them, because they look like they were shot with like a four camera setup if they happened like in real time, but apparently he had one camera and I don't know how he did it. But anyway, this guy Luke Lorenzen, basically he had, I think he had a friend who was working as a hospital chaplain, which is essentially, you know, the job that you do when you're in a hospital and people need spiritual care if they're sick or dying. And so he decided that would be an interesting subject for a film, and basically for a year followed this group of aspiring hospital chaplains who were in a residency and also their mentor. And he, over the course of that year, he kind of zeroed in on this one woman, Mattie, as his subject. And so we basically in the film over a period of time follow her as she speaks with various patients, and then every week they have this group session with the, I think it's four residents and their mentor, who and they're these extraordinarily like emotionally open conversations where these people have to be so articulate about and analytical about their own emotions, and the idea being that they are providing this extraordinary like empathy to these people going through like horrible emotional experiences in hospital, and then they come together in this residency group in order to like talk through how that emotional labor is making them feel, and then they also have one-to-one conversations with their mentor. And then the film also follows the one-to-one conversations that their mentor has with his own mentor or therapist, and his discussions about like how being a mentor is emotionally draining on him. And so the film kind of tracks this, you know, the emotional energy it takes to care for people, and then the care that you then in turn need from other people in order to keep caring, and just how difficult it is to maintain that cycle, especially in a strained medical system, and how the hospital chaplains, as much as like their mentor may try, are not receiving as much care and space as they need. And at the same time, you have this, you know, tracking how this woman Mattie is struggling with the like her own trauma that's brought up by the conversation she has with patients, and the way it makes her think about like her belief or lack of a belief in God, because the job is in nature spiritual, and she tends to people who are very religious and people who aren't, and she herself is very unsure about her own feelings towards spirituality. So the film is kind of, it's dealing with a lot of different things, that main kind of core of it being like what it takes to care for and empathize for other people. And it's so beautifully made and so moving, and I just really like, and it's so impressive in its construction as a documentary. And again, I don't know like how he put this together. It's kind of in the way that you know, sometimes watch like the long extended scenes in Frederick Wiseman films, and you're like, I don't know how like he managed this coverage and knew exactly where to point his camera and when. And yeah, I really, really loved it. I would highly recommend it. It's definitely set a high standard for me, so I'm curious to see if anything is going to surpass it in the festival.
This is our second podcast season about a film festival, so if you're enjoying the Sundance 2023 season, you may also be interested in catching up with our Women at Cannes season from May 2022, where we focus more on the history of the Cannes Film Festival and its track record, or lack thereof, for programming films directed by women. You can find info about the season and episodes on all of the episodes for the season at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. You can also scroll back in our podcast feed and find all of the episodes in that season, which at the moment are still free to everyone.
So this is a section of the Sundance podcast that we will be doing hopefully every episode. It's called Sundance Bingo. If you have seen our Seventh Row social media feeds, you might have seen the amazing bingo card that Alex made. That is always a lot of fun every year. So we kind of, you know, feel like the Sundance programming can be a little bit samey.
they have their slots and they fill them.
Exactly. And so you, after your, like you said, 10 years of covering Sundance, have kind of like gotten a good gauge of what those slots are. Yeah. And put together this bingo card of themes that tend to show up at Sundance. Yeah. And the idea is, as you go along watching your films, cross off which sections, and then I bet you'll have a bingo by the end. So we will be crossing off as we go.
Yeah, I made a different card last year also for the festival, and then I updated it for this year. Mm-hmm. But honestly, like, if you have seen any Sundance films in your life and you make a list of them, you will probably be able to fill out this bingo card.
Mm-hmm. So far, I've crossed off four sections of mine.
So have I.
Yeah, I've got Patriarchy Sucks.
Okay.
Patriarchy Sucks is one that you usually, like, will have multiple films that apply every year. And
that's for Mama Cruz?
This was Mama Cruz, yes. And then we have Indigenous Story, directed by Setzler, which is a film we haven't talked about yet because I don't believe the embargo has broken, but it's twice colonized. And, you know, I don't think it's under embargo that is an Indigenous film directed by a settler. And you also get British World Dramatic Comp film twice, and I get
twice.
It once.
Yeah.
Yes, I have Scrapper, and you have Scrapper and Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Middle-Aged Woman Makes Dubious Sexual Choices. The film that fits that we talked about in the last episode in Spotlight, that would be Other People's Children.
Yeah. So I guess I get that slot too, so I have five.
Oh, yes. And what ones do you have that I don't have?
So I have Climate Change is Bad Drama, and that's for yeah. Blueback, where Mia Wasikowska plays a marine biologist who's worried about coral bleaching. And a bunch of other stuff that's happening to the land and the marine environment because of climate change. It's a smart movie because it's not like just a preachy thing. But anyway, we'll talk about it in a later episode, but that's where I get that X. And then Rape Culture for When It Melts. Well, I guess also, I mean, how many movies are there where somebody gets sexually assaulted? So... yeah. I think you could also argue Heroic is about partly about rape culture.
I think you could argue that any film about rape culture is also about Patriarchy Sucks.
That's true. Usually Patriarchy Sucks, though, is like the films that usually fall where we pick that is like there's some man doing something horrible or somebody faces really mm-hmm. bad sexism. And I wouldn't say I've seen a film where that's like the central tenet.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen some docs that almost fit the boundary pushing docs in Next, except they didn't quite push enough boundaries or they weren't very good. So we weren't
still
sure
waiting
that.
I'm sure there'll be one. Well, I think surely the Tube of Thieves. I mean, I guess you didn't finish the Tube of Thieves because even if you didn't like it, that sounds like it was pushing something.
That's true. Okay, I guess I can get half of a square for that.
Yeah. But I'm still waiting on a couple films in next documentaries that I think maybe might fit that.
Yeah. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the bingo card, and you can also find it on our social media on Twitter and Instagram at Seventh Row, SEVENTHROW. If you're playing along at home, please use the hashtag Sundance Bingo so we can follow your own bingo cards and or tag us. So that's the end of our discussion of our latest dispatch from Sundance of films we've seen. There are a bunch of episodes in our archives that we think might be of interest to you if you were interested in some of the things we talked about in this discussion. So first off, we're now on episode 3 of our Sundance 2023 season, so it's a good time to catch up on episode 1, where we preview the festival, and episode 2, where we talk about the festival's Spotlight program, which is the one program dedicated to films that have screened at other festivals, but maybe didn't quite get the attention they deserved. we raved about Fancy Dance in this episode, which is about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And there's another great film that addresses this topic, fiction film out of Canada. And that film is Rustic Oracle by Sonia Boileau. And we actually talked about that on one of our two episodes on Indigenous YA out of Canada. And this one is in episode 63, part 2. And that episode is only available to members. We also talked a bit about how we're on the lookout for creative nonfiction at the festival. And Orla talked about Still Small Voice, which kind of fits into that category. And so if you're interested in hearing about Sundance and a bit more about the history of Sundance's programming of creative nonfiction, we actually talked about that in our Sundance 2022 episode on creative nonfiction, which is episode 123. And I believe that's still free to everyone. Anything else that we mentioned for films that we've talked about before in the past, including our coverage of past Sundance film festivals, you can find in our podcast archives. But episodes that are older than 6 months are generally only available to members, and many new episodes are also only available to members. So if you'd like to catch up with those episodes, we recommend becoming a member, which you can do at 7th-row.com/join. Finally, we want to put out a plea. If you would please rate and review the episode. I discovered today that if we want to list the Seventh Row podcast on Rotten Tomatoes, we need at least 200 ratings, and we're 150 plus away from that. So if you want to go and hit 5 stars for the episode and also the podcast, that would be huge for us. We'd also,
it actually helps in a very material
way. Yeah, like if we get indexed on Rotten Tomatoes for the podcast, that'll bring a lot of new listeners and mean that films that nobody has heard of that we talk about on the podcast will show up on Rotten Tomatoes when someone's looking for them. And we'd also, if you have things to say, we would really love to get a review. We cherish every review we get of the podcast, even the nasty ones or the angry ones.
We have fun with those.
We have fun with those. Of course, we'd love to hear if you actually like the podcast, why you do. And yeah, the podcast season is still ongoing. We'll have several more episodes going throughout the Sundance Film Festival and a bit after the festival. So we would encourage you to tell your friends about it, share the season with others. And you can find all of our episodes for the season and more info about the season on our website at 7th-row.com/Sundance. You'll also be able to find the episodes and our detailed show notes, where we'll link to all the stories that we talk about and stuff that's on our website that we mention in the episode, our ebooks, related episodes, etc. We also recommend subscribing to the podcast so you don't miss another episode. An additional way, I actually do this for a lot of podcasts because I don't always keep up with my podcast feed, and I like getting the ping in my inbox to let me know there's a new podcast that might be of interest to me. So we have a newsletter for the podcast, and you can tell us that you're specifically interested in the Sundance 2023 season. Email.7th-row.com is for just the general email signup. If you add a /Sundance23, you can sign up specifically for the Sundance updates. We will also put a link in the show notes to the bingo card and to all the books we talked about on the episode, and that you can find, in the show notes in your podcatcher, and also there will be a link to the show notes on the website. Orla, where can people find you and your up-to-the-minute thoughts on Sundance?
Not super up to the minute. I don't want to promise that, but a little more up to the minute than this podcast.
I just watched this movie and I loved it or hated it or
yes, not as in depth as this podcast.
No,
occasionally more up to date. At Orla Mango on Twitter, and at @Ola_P_Smith on Instagram. And then, yeah, every few days on this podcast, now during Sundance, you can hear my voice talking about movies.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at bwestcineast, bwestcineaste. You can find both of us on the Seventh Row accounts on Twitter and Instagram at Seventh Row, SeventhRow. We hope you'll join us in a couple of days for our next dispatch from the festival. Thanks for listening.